Welcome to Enclave on Air. I'm your host today, Jax DiEugenio. In today's episode, supported by Takeda, we had the pleasure of speaking with Anyi Chan, MD, a hematologist-oncologist at the Moffitt Cancer Center, Magnolia Campus in Tampa, Florida, and Bradley D. Hunter, MD, the Medical Director of Oncology and the Director of Immune Effector Cell Therapy at Intermountain Healthcare in Salt Lake City, Utah, about evolving treatment strategies in chronic myeloid leukemia. In our exclusive interview, Drs. Chan and Hunter discussed the integration of asciminib as a first-line therapy for patients with CML, optimal treatment sequencing in CML management, and how findings from the Phase 2 OPTIC trial have influenced ponatinib dosing strategies in patients with chronic phase disease. They also addressed the role of mutational testing in guiding treatment selection strategies to mitigate adverse effects and the evolving role of stem cell transplantation in the treatment paradigm.
My name is Anyi Chan. I'm one of the faculty members at the Moffitt Cancer Center, and my main disease of focus are treating myeloid malignancies, including CML.
My name is Brad Hunter. I am Associate Professor of Research at Intermountain Health, and as part of my clinical practice, I see patients with a myriad of hematologic malignancies. I perform stem cell transplants on CAR T cell therapy, but also see many referrals from outlying sites in our network for questions about hemolignancy. So I do see a fair amount of CML, both frontline and then in later line settings.
Now that asciminib is available as a first line therapy, how have you integrated this agent into your practice?
I use asciminib as first line in a lot of my newly diagnosed chronic phase CML patients now. My goal for these patients are almost always a chance for discontinuation in the future. So compared to other TKIs, I like that asciminib, you know, and the ask for first study showing higher MMR rates. While in a stratum where they compare asciminib with first and second gen TKI, the increase was not statistically significant. It was still numerically, 10% higher. And the more favorable side effect profile is also a major consideration when I put patients on this medication. So yeah, I mean, there are still some cases where I would consider other TKI as frontline, especially if I run into insurance issue or if patients have low-risk disease. But certainly, asciminib become a major part of my practice.
Yeah, I think you can easily argue that in an ideal world, we would be offering asciminib to a lot of patients based on both just what Dr. Chan said, the favorable side effect profile, both what's in the trial and I think what we've seen empirically in our own patients, and then also the higher MMR rate. We do know that typically that overall survival tends to track with complete cytogenic remission rate. So because of that, I think we do feel comfortable offering patients other TKIs if there are insurance coverage issues or just financial toxicity in general. A patient's insurance may cover a TKI, but their copay may be $1,000 or something that's unaffordable. So, you know, I agree. I would tend to offer asciminib when able. There are many patients that we see that are of lower SES or just have coverage issues. And so in those instances, you know, I still will use imatinib at times. I can now get it from what I think $34 I checked this morning from Cost Plus Drug. So I think that, you know, there are avenues or there are places where patients can better afford these things. And it's unfortunate we don't have a system or a world right now in which we can always offer the best therapy to each patient.
How do you typically approach treatment sequencing in the first through third line settings?
So now that asciminib is approved, like I mentioned earlier, I do put a lot of patients on asciminib as first line. So if not asciminib, then typically it's a second generation or the front line. So then second line is either, you know, second gen or asciminib, depending on what they receive for front line. If patient intolerated or progressed through asciminib and a second gen, typically, I would consider ponatinib as third-line therapy, mainly because I think the chance of another second-gen working in that setting is not very high. And I also closely monitor these patients, most likely refer them to see the BMT doctor. If there's any signs of no response, of loss of response, then transplant can be considered as well.
Yeah, I think Dr. Chan and I would practice well together. I have similar things to say. Yeah, again, in this kind of ideal world where we can get the drug we want and the patient can take it, I think asciminib second gen and then ponatinib makes a lot of sense. And I think that that's a great approach. I do think it's also important, and I'm sure Dr. Chan does this too, but that when patients are having progression of disease, to check a TKI resistance panel to see if there are specific mutations which might predict response to one TKI or another. So in that setting, you may tailor your approach to a specific TK based on mutational profile, but in the absence of guiding data in that respect, then yes, exactly what Dr. Chan just said.
Where does ponatinib fit into the treatment sequence based on the findings from the OPTIC trial?
Looking at the OPTIC trial, patients in the third line beyond were offered, you know, ponatinib at three different dosing regimens. One was to start with 45 milligrams, one with 30 milligrams, and one with 15 milligrams. In the 30 and 45 milligram cohorts, if patients achieved a major cytogenetic response, then they were able to go down to 15 milligrams. So in looking at that trial, you know, what was interesting is that patients did have more rapid responses if they got the higher doses up front. And then patients who then had long-term exposure to 15 milligrams, it looks like, at least compared to the PACE trial, we saw lower rates of treatment-emergent adverse events, especially the arterial occlusive events, which suggests that maybe from a toxicity standpoint, you may be able to kind of do a better job in terms of lowering those event rates if you use the 15 milligrams long-term and then kind of do an induction with 45 or 30 milligrams up front. So based on that, you know, many people around the country, myself included, have opted for, when we use ponatinib, to start with 45 milligrams, but then rapidly decrease to 15 milligrams based on response.
Yeah, so I completely agree with Dr. Hunter. I think the OPTIC trial showed that ponatinib is a potent TKI that can be utilized safely with the appropriate monitoring and dose reduction. Well, especially for like fit patient without cardiac comorbidities, I usually start them with ponatinib 45 milligrams with the goal of quickly achieve MR2 so that we can reduce ponatinib to 15 milligrams. For my practice, as well as, you know, the data supports that 15 milligrams daily, I think for the most part, patient can tolerate it well long-term. And, you know, if the patient is less fit or depending on their comorbidities, I think starting with ponatinib 30 is reasonable. And even if 15 milligrams, if there are no other better choices.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think one of the interesting things that we see out of the 5-year OPTIC data, which was presented at ASH, is that if you look at the 5-year PFS and OS, they look to be the same for patients, whether or not they were on the 15, 30, or 45 milligram cohort. Now, I think all of us want to get our patients into disease response as early as possible. But for patients who you may worry about their tolerability of ponatinib, or you worry about a potential cardiovascular risk, I think you could feel reassured if you were back against the wall, you could start with a lower dose and still likely in the long term achieve similar results.
An unexpected outcome of the 5-year readout of the OPTIC trial was that ponatinib was found to prevent the BCR-ABL gene from mutating and causing treatment resistance. What is the significance of this finding?
So I think it is an interesting finding. I think more analysis needs to be done to see if it can help find out the mechanism of how it prevents mutation and or resistance, and see what, you know, subset of prime facial mutations are benefiting. Probably more studies needed, because I think the data that was shown is still pretty preliminary.
As Dr. Chan mentioned a bit earlier, you know, we know that ponatinib is a potent drug. I mean, outside of CML, it's also used in the upfront setting for ALL with really good results. And so, you know, I think it just kind of lends credence to this thought that it's a really potent TKI. And I agree, more research is needed. However, I do think that it helps us to know that keeping patients on drug makes a difference. One of the reasons could be just adherence. You know, some of the second generation TKIs and imatinib have an adherence problem because of their side effects, a lot of the GI, skin, and other things. So it may just be that patients who are on ponatinib also just are able to stay on it longer because of tolerability. Maybe that's playing a role with some of the prevention of emergence of mutations.
Are there any other findings from the OPTIC trial that you would like to highlight?
One of the things that I found that was interesting was the number of arterial occlusive events that were seen in these patients. One of the reasons that, you know, ponatinib has had a difficult journey is in the early data that there was a pretty high preponderance of these arterial occlusive events. So looking at the 5-year data, they looked at the patients across the different cohorts, the ones that started with 45, with 30, and with 15. And the rates of arterial occlusive events per 100 patient years were 4.1 in the 45 milligram cohort, 3.4 in the 30 milligram cohort, and 1.2 in the 15 milligram cohort. So it did look like much lower rates of arterial occlusive events in this trial as compared to previous experiences with ponatinib. So it may be, you know, and we do dose reductions and we give aspirin and we do our best to try to prevent these events. But, you know, when you get down into one per 100 patient year rates, then I start to wonder what is the difference between that and the general population. I do think it'll be important to have continued research looking into the true risk of these events with ponatinib as compared to other agents and compared to just general population. It may be that they're lower than we originally anticipated.
OPTIC again kind of highlight the drug can be, you know, very well tolerated and potent with the appropriate management. Also, I would say highlighting the T315I subset, they achieve very good response with this drug.
Is there anything else about CML management that you would like to add?
I think this year's ASH, you know, we see some pretty exciting new agents in the horizon. So, I mean, hopefully in the future, more patients can be discontinued from treatment to help alleviate, you know, some of these like long-term side effects or financial toxicities. I think that's a major goal for the Crohn's phase CML. I think VAS phase CML remain like a major challenge. So better treatment is needed from that perspective.
Yeah, I can't but help being a stem cell transplanter myself to just blood the stem cell transplant still remains, unfortunately, but it still remains, you know, a treatment option for this disease. Definitely not first, second, third line. But I think once you're getting to third line and beyond, it makes sense to have patients see a transplant team just for evaluation to see if they might be candidates and then to kind of come up with a game plan together with the patient's primary CML oncologist to kind of figure out when might be the right time. It is still one of the diseases that responds to transplant the best. I'm talking about CML in chronic phase. That's the last thing I would say is if you have patients who have had multiple lines of therapy, it is something that should be considered.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive on Air, supported by Takeda. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and follow our OncLive page on Instagram. If you like today's episode of OncLive on Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thank you again for listening to OncLive on Air.